And they can be hypervigilant.
A lot of schizophrenics can, especially those that are paranoid. And you see that hypervigilance again with what disease process we've talked about. PTSD, okay? They're always just kind of on guard, you know, scared that something's going to happen. All right. Questions so far?
I just want to double check to say we don't need to worry about like the different types of schizoaffective disorder and all that, right?
Right, right, because they're all basically treated the same and everything. Yeah, because you could really, you know, there's just one little smidgen of stuff that separates them. But the main thing to know with that type of generalized diagnosis, that they're treated the same and what you need to do. I'm more concerned with you knowing those different thoughts and behaviors and stuff that they can display. So, you know, they have a lot of schizophrenia individuals have a comorbidity of substance abuse and depression. Okay. Now, those aren't atypicals. What comorbidities might you look for medically? Come on. You're schizophrenic, atypical antipsychotics. What comorbidities medically are you going to be concerned about?
Diabetes.
Diabetes! And what else?
High blood pressure.
High blood pressure. Okay. What I was looking for was obesity. Remember? Now you can get that weight gain really fast. But diabetes was the other one. Very good. Very good. Okay. So, on the mental aspect, a lot of comorbidity of abusing substances and being depressed. And on the medical aspect, especially if they're on atypical antipsychotics, the diabetes and obesity. And that's why a lot of them quit medication, because they start gaining weight. Oh, I see Ms. Hart's here. Don't you find that true, Ms. Hart? Can you talk?
Yeah, they do. They start gaining a lot of weight, and particularly right around the abdominal area, which is that apple shape that you see, and of course what? That's where all your major internal organs are, so you have, you know, a lot of fat around those, and that's not healthy, you know. They try to medicate themselves with the alcohol and the drugs, and then they decide they don't need the medicine anymore, so they have an exacerbation again. So it's just a big old circle of stability, exacerbation, acute treatment, and then don't you think of it, Dr. Alexander, as a chronic disorder of illness like diabetes or hypertension? They can achieve high-level wellness, you know, if they take their medicines and they stay in therapy, but it's a lifestyle change. It's a chronic disease process.
Yes, very much so. And you can just, somebody diagnosed with schizophrenia because of their high risk for suicide, because of the medications that they start having to take to control their illness, that can cause these unfortunate medical problems, you can just automatically shave 5 to 10 years off their lifespan. You know, unfortunately, I hate to say that, but that seems to be the case. And you know,
they look a lot older than they actually are because they've had such a hard lifestyle. I'm always shocked that I think maybe somebody is 60 years old and they're 45.
Mm-hmm. That is most true. And it usually presents when? Y'all know when?
It presents younger in males than it does in females, typically before the age of 25 in males, I think it was.
Uh-huh.
And then after that in females, which is why they're prognosis is worse, because the younger they were when diagnosed, the worse your prognosis is or something?
Yes. Very good. Very good. So let's think 19, it's like 18, 19 to 20s, okay? Now, I told y'all about stress being a trigger. So what happens kind of during that time in your life that's a major change that...
Moving out of your parents' house, like coming out of high school and onto your own, trying to adult for the first time?
Exactly. Yes, stepping into that adult role, okay? Although it may be exciting and a good change, you're looking forward to it, it's still stressful. And remember how I talked about that stress being a trigger in some form or fashion? Okay. What am I missing, Miss Hart? As far as schizophrenia.
All of those strange communication patterns, that disorganized thinking that's in your book that they talk about, and the disorganized behavior.
Yeah.
So we need to know those really well.
I told him to review those very good, the disorganized behavior and thoughts, okay? And the other different types of disorganized perceptions, like the hallucinations and that type of thing.
You can see it in children, but they don't diagnose it early on. It's been diagnosed as young as five, but we don't try to label them too quickly. We're hoping it's just something, you know, other than schizophrenia. But there have been children that have been diagnosed with schizophrenia. There was a thing on 60 Minutes one night, parents of schizophrenic children, and one mother's child had it so severe she had to rent an apartment and remove that child from the home because she was so abusive and physically abusive to others, you know. So it can be diagnosed in children. And I think Dr. Alexander made a good point. Depression walks hand in hand with schizophrenia. Hopefully you won't see anybody in a catatonic stupor as much now because we're going to recognize sooner the disease process, medicate them sooner, but it is possible. And one of the things that, you know, there's a classic symptom of it is that waxy flexibility where you can take their hand, you can put it like this, and they'll sit there like that. So what would be some nursing interventions for delusions? What would you want to do with that patient?
You want to acknowledge that you don't see, like if they, not ordering my thoughts, I'm sorry, that it's not like that. You don't want to like confront their delusion because you can't change their delusion, but I don't see whatever it is that's going on to try and reorient them. Okay, yeah.
That's memory delusions are false belief.
Yeah.
And generally fixed. So what you going to do? I don't want you to get this way right now because you're driving. But
you want to distract them?
That's right.
It's okay. I'm going 10 miles per hour right now. I'm on my driveway.
But you're right about hallucinations, you know, acknowledge that that must be scary to think, to hear that or to see that, but I don't see it. I don't hear it. What would you say, Ms. Hart?
You're muted,
Ms. Hart. Are you talking?
If someone's very scared or very frightened from hallucinations, what are you going to do with them? How are you going to treat them? What would be your interventions there? A, move them to a quiet area if you can. Don't leave them alone. Acknowledge their fear. Tell them you're going to stay with them and they're safe where they are. So, you know, you're just very supportive. And then sometimes if the anxiety level is extremely high there, what would be your next step?
Benzo drugs?
Possibly look to see if they have something ordered for sedation. And if they do, then offer them some. And some will tell you, yes, I would like that. You know, I need something to calm down, or I'm very, you know. And if you offer them something for sedation, then what are you going to help them do? Lie down, maybe not leave them alone. Get them out of a highly stimulated area. You know, I've got to get up and walk. Probably got to give me the pain before so I can better tolerate it. So if I'm having mental pain and you give me a sedation, the best thing to do is what? Remove me from all that stimulation so I can, what? Get the benefit of what you gave it to me for. Are you going to leave me alone?
No.
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 And if you as a nurse are busy on the unit, what would you need to do to make sure that I'm not alone? Delegate that to what? One of the what? The
CNA.
Nursing?
Mm-hmm.
CNA. Uh-huh. And what are you going, what, and when you delegate that and you've got a disturbed patient, what is your responsibility there?
You need to continue to check on them.
Very good. Continue to what? Communicate with that CNA to make sure that they're watching them closely, and you need to tell them what we're going to watch them for. Are they seeming to calm down? Or are they quieter? You know, what you're going to let them observe and make sure that you communicate to them what the observation is there. It's just like what? If you tell a CNA to go take a blood pressure for you, then what? It's your job to analyze that blood pressure. Whether it needs to be retaken, is it okay? Is it out of whack? You know, so it's our job, even though we delegate, to still what? Provide the communication aspect of that for me. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. Dr. Alexander can speak to this too. I had a patient once who was very scared, very schizophrenic, thought the devils were after her and they were going to kill her, okay?
You're playing hide and seek too?
So we got some medication, got her quiet, got her sedated, got some sedation on board. But I could tell that CNA was scared to death. Okay? Could tell by the way she was sitting in the room, you know, kind of like. So
you're
what
going
was
to
my
sleep?
Job there? To reassure her I was around, I was going to chat, and I was going to be around. And if she needed me, put the buzzer where she could get me very quickly. Because those situations when a patient gets like that can be frightening for everyone involved.
Very good, very good. Totally great points. Now, in your listening to Ms. Hart's voiceover and studying and everything, what are two things that y'all learned that we have to watch for in these patients that you don't see in other patients?
Very
bizarre things.
Oh, not bizarre.
Like the schizophrenic that's wearing a big winter coat in the middle of summer. And the schizophrenic that goes to the water fountain and keeps filling up his cup.
The polydipsia.
Okay. What are the two bizarre things that you have to watch for?
Was it polydipsia?
Well, yeah, because they have that water, okay,
so
imbalance.
Then they get the electrolyte imbalance because they have too much water in them, and then they end up drinking things that they shouldn't drink, possibly.
Right. They can get water intoxication, and you have to watch them for that. Okay. I know one of the units that I used to work on, we had water fountains, you know, at both ends of the unit, and we had a schizophrenic on the unit that was kept drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking, and we literally had kit maintenance to come up and turn those water fountains off. Okay? So that's not something you see, you know, in other patients there with other mental problems. That's kind of unique to the schizophrenic. And what's the other one? They have problems with what?
I can't remember what it was called, but when the thermoregulation.
Thermoregulation. Yeah. Okay. So in the middle of winter, they may strip off all their clothes off and go running around naked. Okay. And then
call the healthcare provider, who's probably going to order what? A complete blood count. But how's the patient going to look to you to make you suspect that?
Dizzy, tachycardic, maybe.
Infections.
Signs of infection. Fever. Sore throat.
Nausea, vomiting.
Malaise. Just generally not feeling well. Okay?
If I come up to you and I'm on that drug and I say, God, you know, my throat is killing me. You going to give me that medication? You're going to hold it, okay? So think about when somebody has something, what are you going to see in them as a nurse, okay? In agranulocytosis, what do white blood cells do? If I'm getting
infection.
What do you see in my blood work, though?
Low blood count.
You see that shift to the left, right? And all those little immature things, the basophils and the little... They all try to come in, what? Because they're trying to help that white blood cell count come back up, okay? So you see that. Y'all remember that shift to the left from your patho? Nobody? Somebody remember it?
Vaguely.
But think about that. That's an important... A complete blood count on any patient is extremely important, okay? And when you see that shift to the left, and all that is all those little immature things that end up being a white blood cell are really what? Trying to kick in, give that patient some white blood cells. So that's why as a healthcare provider, you'll see a complete blood count ordered, okay? The other thing, okay, we talked about I'm drinking way, way too much water. I'm just having a big old time. I'm even getting water out of the commode, and they will do that. What lab value you going to look at there? What would be important to look at there? What follows water?
Sodium.
Salt.
Sodium, the sodium level. And sodium is related to potassium, so, you know, those are two very important electrolytes. How would you expect my sodium to be?
It's going to fall. It's going to be low.
Very diluted, right? So what's a normal sodium range?
135 to 145.
So if it's very diluted, it's probably going to be what?
Less than 135.
And it can even go down much lower than that. And so what would you expect your patient to look like? I got low sodium and I'm just drinking everything I can get. I'm even in the flowers. Ms. Dr. Alexander's just watered the flowers and I'm going to pick the flower pot up and I'm getting some more water out of here. And she's just fussing at me, but I'm just drinking, steadily drinking.
Confused,
maybe. Maybe I'm a little confused, a little disoriented, and maybe I'm kind of got a little fine tremor that could eventually lead to a seizure if that's not corrected, okay, is what a low sodium level will do. So look at your patient. When you think about, oh, I say they got agranulocytosis, I want you to think, what do I need to look at in the patient? What do I need to assess? Because assessment is the most important thing you will do as a nurse. And these psych patients need all kind of assessments. Because like Dr. Alexander said, they not only have a mental problem, they got physical problems too. Does that make sense to everybody? And that was the two things up.
Yes, ma'am.
I can't think of really anything else.
Okay. Well, if you think of something, we can add it in. Let's move on to mania, bipolar.
okay, unless anybody else has a question about chapter 22. Okay, you know, my a person experiencing bipolar looks that is in mania is very psychotic. They have a lot of those positive symptoms. Okay. Now, what is a euphoric mood?
Elevated, happy.
Elevated, yes. Okay. So, what's the difference between a euphoric mood and an expansive mood? Okay. Expansive mood is when they have lack of restraints. You know, they kind of are in your face, getting your personal space, okay, and have that grandiose, self-important type of expression. So, a lot of times when people hear mania, and they can have either mood in mania, okay, but the general public kind of think of euphoria, that they're just having a big high. But a lot of times it's that expansive mood that they're experiencing too. Because these individuals can literally get in your face and in your part. They have no boundaries or anything when they're experiencing that expansive mood type of situation. Okay? And I like to explain that because I don't want students kind of getting in that mindset that the general public has, that somebody that's bipolar is just very, very, very happy and on a high, because they can be very dangerous because of that expansive mood that can happen. Okay?
It's like they're all up in your business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, what is the difference between bipolar 1 and bipolar 2? Anybody? Bipolar 1 is the, you know, mania, depression. Okay? And they have, it's kind of balanced out to a degree, but they do have true manic episodes. That's the key. All right? They do become manic. Bipolar 2, you don't really see a manic episode. If they kind of get close to that, it's kind of what we describe as hypomanic. All right? And they do generally experience that more of a euphoric mood than they do an expansive mood when they get to that point. All right? So they're more, they have more of the depressive type symptoms and everything. Okay? Y'all with me? Okay? So what's the gold standard to treat bipolar?
Lithium.
Okay, why?
Hello, Tiffany.
I don't remember. Because number one, it's cheap, right? And it addresses both the mania and the depressive symptoms. Okay? All right. So tell me what's the other class of drugs that if lithium has to be discontinued or if there's some reason they can't take it, what's the other class of drugs commonly used?
Mood stabilizers.
Mood stabilizers, also known as what? The particular
Antidepressants.
You can use antipsychotics to help control the positive symptoms and everything.
Antidepressants?
No, anticonvulsants, remember? Your carbamazepine, your valproic acid, okay, and your lamotrigine, okay? Those are the three other big popular drugs. Now, with my experience, with the exception of bipolar 1, sometimes I do see them use the valproic acid or Depakote as opposed to lithium. I know one of the psychiatrists in the past says he sees Depakote work better than lithium in bipolar male patients that are real prissy. And that's how he worded it. So, you know, with his experience, he seemed to see that work better. But they're used more so with the bipolar 2. You'll kind of see them ease those medications in if they're suspecting that a patient might be bipolar and have bipolar 2. Okay? Now, do you remember the risk of SSRIs if you start one? And somebody who's a true bipolar patient, what it can do, it possibly can do, it can cause them to have a mania episode. Okay? So they'll be cautious in using SSRIs if they have a diagnosis of bipolar. And unfortunately, sometimes that's how physicians find out that, well, this patient doesn't have depression, they have bipolar, they just haven't had a manic episode yet, but, you know, because I thought it was depression, and I treated them with fluoxetine, okay, it caused them to have a manic episode. Now, I'm not saying you won't ever see a patient with bipolar on SSRI, because there are patients out there that are on them, okay? They also, to think about somebody, mania is kind of your main focus, okay, when you think about your interventions and everything when you get to this chapter. I'm not saying the depressive part isn't important, because it is, but it's not any different than what you learned in your depression chapter. Okay, so mania is the unique animal here. So we're going to focus on mania a little bit. Think about, what is your biggest intervention, somebody who's truly in a manic episode? Anybody?
Playing loud music and inviting them out to a dance.
Remember, they being in an expansive mood. I'm indispensable. I'm in your face. I'm in your place.
You are also calling me stupid. Mm-hmm. And you're the king of the world. Can you tell that would be very irritating to others? So you're not going to invite me to the dance. You're not going to take me anywhere like that. Even though I want to go. And I'm just going to say you're mean and stupid. And if you could dance, you'd take me. And if you'd have been smart, you'd have been a doctor. You wouldn't just be a dumb old nurse.
So these patients are all over the place. They're up in your space. They're hanging out windows. You know, they're impulsive, getting in everybody's space, pissing people off. What comes to mind? Oh, how about safety? Okay, safety for that patient, because they could really piss off another patient. And they start beating up on them, okay?
and for the other patients around them, okay? So, safety is a big issue. They get very suicidal and either the extreme manic phase too, and the extreme depressive phase. But their depression is just like major depressive disorder that we discussed. So that's your priority care issue with mania. Safety, always, always, always. So if you have a manic patient that jumps up on the pool table and starts picking up balls to throw, what are you going to do first?
Maybe remove the other people from the room?
You're on mute, Miss Hart. But you hit the nail on the head. Yes,
I was going to say, don't say nitty nitty boo boo. Hit me if you can.
You were muted. Exactly. Exactly. That's the right answer. Because your safety, okay, yeah. Are you going to have more success at trying to get that patient down and keep them safe, or first get the other people out of the room? You know, yeah, remove those other people because you already have one person that's up on the table and acting all crazy and everything. So you don't want them to hurt anybody else. What also about mania that needs to be addressed? If they're up and all over the place constantly in your space, always getting into other people's business, constantly moving, what else are you going to be concerned about? You think these folks are eating like they should? You think they're sleeping like they should? Do y'all know how long a typical mania episode is? On average. I'm talking about average because, you know, it can...
Wasn't it a few weeks?
7 days, generally.
Okay, a week.
Okay. But that's average. But imagine going 90 to nothing for 7 days. What a toll it's going to be on their body physically. And if they're not eating like they should, and they sure aren't getting any sleep, if they're in that bad manic phase, okay, they're going to need some assistance, don't you think? And probably not attending to daily hygiene needs like they need to, all right, okay? But, or sometimes they could be overdoing it. And a lot of times when that patient comes out of their manic episode, a lot of them don't remember how bad they behaved, okay? So always keep that in mind, too. And you don't want to embarrass them or belittle them, although they can really get under your skin sometimes, like Ms. Hart said. So what's one of the key... Somebody that comes in with mania, what's one of the first lab things you want to go look at? Any papers? How about thyroid? Why would I be concerned about thyroid?
The symptoms of underactive thyroid can mimic mania? Or was that a different one?
You were right the first time.
Okay, overactive.
Yes. Okay. And there are bipolar patients that have hyperthyroidism. So So can you imagine if they develop Graves' disease on top of mania? But yeah, you do have to, like, the big issue contributing to their problems and everything.
Oh, I feel bad for laughing.
No. I've just enjoyed seeing you driving, and now you're cooking us dinner.
Are you making fried chicken? Are you making gumbo?
I am making chicken wing, buffalo chicken wings.
Oh, good. I want that too.
Well, you're more than welcome. I'm cooking for, we're all here, so eight. So I just saw my oldest son on the drive here. I saw him. He's at the house. I'm so excited.
Good. All right. What else was hard about bipolar? Oh, tell him about the kindling theory.
That's
important.
I've got to remember it. I've been teaching farm this afternoon, so my mind is just... I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I've been talking about sedation and analgesics.
Uh-huh.
Let me think. Kindling. Do you remember?
Kindling theory is that, again, like I said, that stressor that can trigger an episode, that somebody that develops it, bipolar or something, had the same kind of stress or situation that kept happening over and over and over. And it's a theory behind the development of bipolar, but you might hear that used in the hospital. Okay.
They weren't developmentally ready for it, but it kept happening and happening.
Right.
That same stress. And so they get around it again, and it triggers a lot of stuff for them.
Right.
I wanted to tell you about manic people, too. They can be very destructive in their family because they spend a lot of money when they're in that phase. They buy a lot of things. They can be very promiscuous sexually. So, you know, by the time the 7 days is over, they can have spent all the family savings and have three new cars in the parking lot if somebody will sell them to them. And so they wreak a lot of havoc financially and emotionally and those kind of things. And sometimes when they first come in, they can be so high and so delusional, they're hard to tell from an acute schizophrenic phase. Probably one of the main differential diagnoses between the two is schizophrenics have more command hallucinations, where manics have more delusions of grandeur, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And command hallucinations, we forgot to tell you that a minute ago, you know, you want to know what the command, what the voices are telling them to do. Are they telling me to go kill somebody or harm somebody? So you always want to ask that question. So when manics come in, they can not, you know, they can be very physically exhausted. So looking at their fluid and electrolytes, their cardiac status, getting them, sometimes they have to be sedated initially on an antipsychotic till whatever, if they choose to give them lithium or whatever, can kick in. Because some of these medicines, if you'll notice, even the anticonvulsants have therapeutic levels they have to reach. And remember, your amygdala's got the Stephen Johnson syndrome with the rash.
Right.
And there is the other one there that has the agranulocytosis too. So be sure and recognize that.
Okay, so any more... Are there any questions about bipolar? Really focus on the mania aspect, because anything depression-wise, you know, it's the same thing as when we talked about depression. Okay, let's move on to our personality disorders. What did y'all think about that? Do y'all know anybody with a personality disorder?
The president.
Well, have y'all all ever been manipulative in your lifetime in some situation? No?
Maybe as a child. No, I feel like my children are manipulative.
But you never manipulated a situation to kind of get what you want, or Have you ever in your life wanted to be the center of attention? On your birthday, you want to be the center of attention, right?
This is
true. Sometimes, the party's for you. You kind of want everybody to be focusing on you, or like on your wedding day or something like that. Okay? And it's okay to feel proud of yourself and kind of put yourself on a little pedestal every now and then. We all tend to have these traits. We can get paranoid at times. Okay? We can kind of withdraw and not want to be around people. We'd rather be by ourselves. So what makes it a personality disorder? It's when, and these are the key terms you need to remember, okay? It's inflexible, okay? There's an impairment in that individual's ability to hold down relationships or work, okay? And it's stable over time. Now, don't get that confused with, you think of a personality disorder, you think of somebody being unstable, okay? Stable over time means that that personality becomes part of their norm. When you see the person, you expect that behavior from them because it has become them. Does that make sense? Okay, so don't confuse that. A lot of students will say it's unstable over time. No, the personality becomes stable over time. Okay? And they also have disturbances in their self-identity. Okay? But a lot of that big disturbance is in their interpersonal functioning. So, borderline personality disorder kind of has a chapter in and of itself because it's the most common personality disorder, okay, for one thing. And also, they are high risk for self-harm or suicide, that particular one. So that's why this chapter kind of gives a brief introduction to personality disorders in general, but then really focuses on borderline. So, do y'all understand what a borderline personality disorder is in your studying? They're very unstable individuals, okay? They have marked impulsiveness and very destructive behavior. Now, this is where they have problems. They have problems regulating their mood. They have problems with their self-identity. Okay, and I'm going to talk about identity diffusion in a minute. They have problems maintaining interpersonal relationships. Thinking realistic, and also they are very impulsive, and that's a lot of what makes their behavior so destructive, and where you have to really watch these people. When you meet these individuals initially, they'll appear more competent than they actually are. But they have a lot of self-hate inside. And that's why they're most susceptible to self-mutilating. With borderline individuals, they love chaos. Now, do you remember from your stress chapter, and there's not going to be any questions per se from the crisis grief chapter directly from that per se, unless it ties in to something like this. But I wanted you to understand, like in the crisis chapter, y'all learned that there's no such thing as a chronic crisis. A crisis is time limited, okay? But you think a borderline personality disorder person lives in chronic crisis. Well, what they live in is chaos, constant chaos. And they love and thrive in chaos. Okay? They're drama queens. And you'll find others avoiding them. Okay? Because their emotions are so intense. And then people will start to withdraw, and that borderline person will feel abandoned. So our challenge when we have these patients on the unit is their emotional vulnerability, okay? Their impulsiveness. You have to really watch them because they don't think a thing through. And sometimes they're impulsive because they can be distraught, like I said, with that self-hate and everything. But sometimes they do it for attention. They tend to, another challenge with these individuals is they tend to attract bad relationships. Okay? So a significant other that they may be bring into their life generally isn't good for them. All right. Or if they happen to meet somebody that is good for them, they generally end up sabotaging the relationship by their behavior and how they act. And so, of course, also these individuals have difficulty holding down a job. Have you ever been in a job where there was a constant drama queen, always stirring the pot, keeping things going? Yeah. Those people generally don't last long.
And they love it. They're like the eye of the hurricane. They're all still and quiet in that little circle, and they're just stirring stuff all around. And they love it. Everybody else is miserable. They're perfectly happy.
That's right. Okay, I'm going to try to speed up so we can get done by 4:30. The diagnostic criteria, remember, okay, unstable relationships, interpersonal relationships, okay? They have that imagined fear of abandonment. They have an unstable self-image. That's another diagnostic criteria. And they generally identity diffuse to another person. All right. They have an unstable affect. That means they can have extreme shifts in moods. So I always tell my students the worst patient to take care of, in my opinion, is somebody who has bipolar and also has borderline. Okay. Now they have cognitive dysfunctions. That's the other criteria. And that those cognitive dysfunctions is they can disassociate. Remember that from the PTSD chapter? Okay. They can have that kind of depersonalization or feel like part of their body is not connected to them. But their really dangerous cognitive dysfunction is that dichotomous thinking that they have. And dichotomous thinking is thinking everything is either black or white, all or nothing, okay? There's nothing in between. It's either this extreme or this extreme. And that's what gets them in trouble so much and causes a lot of the unstable interpersonal relationships. Because if they have a boyfriend and their boyfriend goes to work and says, I'll be home at 5, honey, and we'll go out, and it's 5:10 and he ain't home yet, that borderline, because of their black and white thinking, can start saying, he told me he'd be home at 5, it's 5:10. oh my God, he doesn't love me, because he said he'd be here at 5, but it's 5:10. I mean, it's like that for them, folks, okay? And it's hard to get them to see that gray in the middle, because what if the boyfriend is stuck in traffic or something like that? But they go to that extreme absolute that he doesn't love me or whatever. And then they have the behavioral dysfunctions where they're very impulsive and they can do those self-harm behaviors that I talked about, mutilization. And that's where going back to the cognitive dysfunction, that's where the word borderline comes into play, because they actually can kind of slip from sanity into a little bit of insanity or neurosis, okay, from time to time. Splitting. Y'all know what splitting is? It's a big defense mechanism used by borderline individuals, but you need to be aware of it, because they will use splitting. Okay, that's where I can kind of, if I'm a patient and I tell my two nurses, Tiffany and Kevin, okay, Tiffany's taking care of me at night, and I tell her she's just wonderful. She takes such good care of her patients, but that Kevin during the day, he's awful. He's terrible. He's always mean to everybody. He hates me, okay? And then Tiffany leaves and goes home, and Kevin comes home, and I tell Kevin, oh, you were so wonderful. You always take care of me. You are so nice to your patients, but that Tiffany at night, oh my God, she is so mean. I can't stand her. They split because they're trying to get the focus that you're looking at each other, okay, and not at me. But I know eventually y'all are going to figure it out and find out, well, it was Nancy that was telling me this, Nancy telling you this, and she's telling us complete. And I know it's eventually going to come back on me. And so that just, again, satisfies my self-loathing and me feeling terrible about myself and hating myself. Okay? So watch that splitting. They will do it. They're very manipulative. And they do it to manipulate, to get what they want. Okay. There's no pill for borderline or any other personality disorders. No magic pill to make them get better. Cognitive behavioral therapy is generally it. Okay.
I like your hair.
Now, do y'all remember in your studying and everything? Biggest risk factor for the development of personality disorder.
Did you do your schoolwork?
Borderline personality disorder.
Yes, what was that then?
Abuse.
Social studies, right?
Generally, they've suffered some type of abuse in their life. Yes, there's generally a genetic link somewhere, component there. But in every borderline I've ever taken care of or known, there is some type of abuse, whether it's sexual, physical, or emotional. Okay, and that kind of goes back to that trauma chapter. That's a trauma, isn't it? And the development of psychiatric issues and disassociating and that type of thing. Okay, see how it kind of all ties together? All right. What else am I forgetting about borderline, Miss Hart?
We're good.
Okay. Don't ever hug anybody with borderline. Why? because they're going to think you're their new BFF.
I feel like you shouldn't hug anyone anyway.
Well, especially not with borderline. Because, again, that's where that identity diffusion kicks in. And they have that wanting to be loved and fear of abandonment, okay? And they will hook on to you. And if you hug them to be nice and just show them you care, they're going to think you're their new BFF, okay? And set you up to have to let them down. All right. And real quick, your other, if you, that handout I posted, okay, on personality disorders, if y'all will look at that and know that, I think you will be pretty good. You know, there's three clusters. And cluster A is your individuals that are kind of weird and out there, very unique, okay? Erratic sometimes. And they're your paranoid, your schizo, and your schizotypal. Okay, your paranoid, just look them over, but it goes right with the word. Very paranoid that everybody that treats them nice wants something, okay? They can be very angry individuals. And if they do something nice for you, they do expect something, okay? Your schizoid, also some physicians think this is your adult Asperger's. Y'all know what an Asperger's syndrome is? It's that far end of the autism spectrum, okay? But your schizoid, they're very withdrawn individuals. They like things, okay, instead of people. They could care less for people, whether they have people in their life or not. You usually see them in some type of job like IT or where they get to work by themselves and don't have to deal with people. And they're very fascinated with objects. Like I said, these are your people that you see collect things a lot of the times. And if you've ever watched The Big Bang Theory, Sheldon, okay, he's kind of like a poster child with for schizo. Or Napoleon Dynamite. That's a good movie. But those individuals like love, relationships, it's no big thing to them. They don't have to have it. Okay? All right. Schizotypal. Now, these are your schizophrenic-looking individuals. Okay, but they don't have the full criteria to be diagnosed with schizophrenic. They are all over the place. Sometimes with their behavior, they have the highest incidence of body dysmorphic syndrome. Do y'all know what that is? Where you keep trying to make a part of your body better and better and better. Okay, a true life example with this personality disorder was Michael Jackson. Yeah. If you are familiar with Michael Jackson, okay. So that's cluster A, kind of weird individuals. But read that handout, and it goes into more detail with some of the traits and everything with them. I'm trying to move fast through these. Cluster B is your most common type of cluster. Okay, so I don't know why it's not A. Don't ask me why. But it's cluster B, and borderline falls in that cluster B, and it's your most common one, remember? You also have your antisocial. Antisocial does not mean somebody that's withdrawn and doesn't want to deal with you. That's more of a schizo personality disorder. What it means by antisocial is they think the rules don't apply to me. Okay? are anti-social, anti-society. Okay? It doesn't matter. That doesn't apply to me. I'm above that. These are also your, somebody with antisocial personality disorder that is really kind of getting bad is your psychopath, and the worst of the worst is your sociopath. Okay? They lack empathy. And to me, they don't even have any empathy. But I guess they could have a smidgen for those that might be the closest in their life, okay? But, I mean, they could have a very close loved one to them die, and they don't shed a tear. It's no big to them. They're very entitled individuals. Watch out for these people. These people that are antisocial end up in jail or a long-term institution, generally, okay, are dead, okay? They're very manipulative. They can be very charming individuals. And then you have your narcissistic, okay? Narcissistic, there's kind of two types. There's a closeted narcissist and there's a malignant narcissist. So it's your malignant one that you think of when you think of narcissists, somebody that is just, they're better than everybody, okay? But they have a little bit more empathy than antisocial individual. They do have some, and you usually see these individuals married and everything, but they generally marry somebody that puts them up on a pedestal and, you know, just thinks they're superior above everything. They're very grandiose individuals. A lot of these individuals will take credit for things that you do well. And then if they screw up, they'll blame you. Okay? And then your histrionic. These individuals want to be the center of attention. They're very flirtatious. If you ever have a party, you want to invite somebody with histrionic personality disorder. Because they will keep the party going, believe you me. But they like to be the center of attention, and they can be very sexually seductive individuals. But the reason they do it is to gain attention, okay? Not necessarily because they enjoy it or whatever, but they just want that attention. And they use their sexuality and become very flirtatious to gain that. Okay, so that's them in a nutshell. All right. And then your cluster C individuals. Your cluster C are your anxious and fearful individuals. Okay. You have your dependent personality disorder. And these people they'll be totally submissive to you. They are some of the nicest people you will ever meet because they just want to do everything to make you happy and please you, okay? They have disregard for their self, right? And then your obsessive compulsive personality disorder. Don't get this confused with obsessive compulsive disorder. Okay? They're two different things. The obsessive compulsive disorder, they develop obsessions and compulsions due to anxiety. and they do those compulsions to handle their anxiety and everything. But obsessive compulsive personality disorder, okay, they have a perversive pattern of wanting everything just perfect. And they want to be in control, okay? It's their way to kind of control the environment around them. They're very usually individuals that are tense and don't have a lot of joy. And they're your workaholics that you see, the ones that stay late and work all the time, okay? Because they need that control and order in their life. All right. So somebody with obsessive compulsive disorder, you're not necessarily going to see everything alphabetized in their cupboards or whatever. You'll see those compulsive acts. But somebody with obsessive compulsive personality disorder, they're the ones you're going to see everything alphabetized for control. Okay. Does that make sense? Y'all see the difference?
No, they don't.
And then you have your avoidant personality disorder. Your avoidant personality disorder, these are those people that are just so scared that somebody's going to reject them that they don't get out and do stuff. Okay, now I'm not talking about agoraphobia because these folks are out and about, but they just, they're not going to speak up or they're not going to go out their way to start something because they fear that rejection. So they avoid tense situations like that, okay? And so that's where the anxiety cluster kind of fits with those three. For the obsessive compulsive that has to have that control, the dependent, okay, that has to be dependent on others, and the avoidant personality, all right? Okay, kind of flew through those because I know we're past time a little bit, but I wanted y'all to kind of understand the major differences. Do y'all have any questions? What time is it? Oh, we're right on time. It's 4:30. I thought we were past time. Do y'all have any questions about anything? Study that handout. Oh, one more thing I want to stress about antisocial and cluster B real quick. Do y'all remember studying about Freud and how he talked about the id and the ego and the superego? Y'all remember that?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. What is your id?
Wasn't that like the underlying things that made you up, like it was developed when in childhood and everything?
Right. Those primitive reflexes that are in all of us. Okay. Kind of like our survival, you know, traits. What's your ego?
The ego is
self, right? Mm-hmm. And everything. So what is your superego in a nutshell?
Wasn't that like your values and all of that stuff, like the things that are above just like what was making you up, like your personality, but like the major things?
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
With those values and everything, you reach out and care about others, right? It allows you to go beyond your ego, yourself, and care about others. The more you're, because like you think of a little bitty child, is their super ego even close to being developed? No.
That's why they're okay? Egocentric.
A baby is all about id, right? I'm hungry, feed me. I'm sleepy, put me to bed. And then as they become children and everything, that ego really starts to flourish because they know they're a person and they exist. And then that super ego, as we grow and develop more, comes more and more into development.
where we can care about others and do things. So which one of those do you think is underdeveloped in somebody with antisocial personality disorder?
The super ego, because they cannot care about anyone else.
Good. There you go. It makes sense, right? Okay, because they're antisocial. So that was a key thing. And another thing with antisocial, and we'll talk about it more when you get your lecture, even though it's in this chapter, we talk about it more with children, is conduct disorder. You see that in a child, that's a red flag that they're going to have antisocial personality disorder later on. Okay? All right. Anything else, Ms. Hart?
Can't just say anything.
Okay. All right. Well, that's it, y'all, unless you have any more questions. Thank y'all for tuning in. I'll get your study guide to you this weekend, I promise.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Y'all have a good week. Rest of the week.
You too.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.